45. He stepped out of the founder's house into a patch of snow and heard the door shut behind him. He looked over his shoulder and saw an empty hallway through smudged glass. He wondered if Harry and 15 and 33 stood there watching him, hidden from sight, or if the dream had already moved them along to somewhere else. He looked up at the sprawling structure, hoping to see any sign of life, and saw none. He shuffled through the ankle-deep snow, across the back lot, down the gravel side road, and out onto the slush-covered street. No Hudson Hornets, no Model A, nothing. He walked through the slush toward the Silver Arrow. Within half an hour, he learned he'd been gone for over 3 months. He'd missed Christmas and New Year's. People had given up hope. His mother had gone past hysterics to mourning. The fact that Eli's apartment had been found vandalized with the door kicked in and that Zeke Miller vanished a few days later had led to numerous whispered theories. Small towns might not run on gossip, but it tended to be a standard alternative fuel source. People talked a bit louder about Zeke's temper, his stalkerish behavior towards some women, his long history with Eli. Sealed school records became points of coffee shop discussion. Depending on who was asked, Eli had been run out of town, kidnapped, or possibly even murdered. Eli shook his head at all of it. As he explained to many people with complete honesty, he hadn't seen Zeke's face in months. When asked where he'd been, he shrugged and managed to look embarrassed. He'd been struck with wanderlust, taken a few days off, and just kept going. The impulsive after-college road trip, many years late. There may have been a woman involved. People sighed and smiled. Dependable Eli Teague could be just as irresponsible as the rest of them sometimes. It fit well into the history they all liked to believe. Over the next few days, he went back to the station to give statements about his absence to Captain Deacon, to the state police out of Alfred, and to a bored-looking FBI agent out of Portland who'd been called in when Eli's car was found in Boston. A missing persons case had been opened, and procedures had to be followed before it could be closed. No, he hadn't been kidnapped. No, he hadn't been threatened. No, he hadn't seen Officer Miller during that time. Eli sat in the chair and answered all their questions with a straight face. "Are you a steampunk fan?" Eli blinked. "What?" "Steampunk." The FBI agent pointed his pen at the hat sitting on Deacon's desk. "I've got a friend who is. She has a bowler, too."
"It's a derby," corrected Eli.
"What's the difference?"
"I'm not really sure," he said, "but I'm pretty sure there is one."
"Not into steampunk, though." Eli shook his head.
"Strange choice for a hat, then."
Eli shrugged.
"Used to be the most popular hat in the country."
The FBI agent smirked as he packed up his paperwork, his first real expression in their five-minute discussion.
"Yeah, well, what was it Obama said about horses and bayonets?"
Eli's car had been towed from the Boston parking structure and impounded. He owed 13 weeks of storage fees, a frightening sum, if he wanted it back. Much to his surprise, his apartment was still his. Captain Deacon had labeled it a crime scene after Zeke's disappearance. The lock on the door had been fixed, but the rest of the small space had been left as they'd found it. Eli cleaned up a few things and threw away many more. His bed felt too soft. So he dragged the blankets onto the floor, cracked the windows open, and slept soundly in the cold, fresh air. He'd been equally surprised to find out he still had a job. Bill had hired a new systems person, a woman with spiky hair, dark eyes, and a much more impressive resume than Eli, but after his absence and reported disappearance, no one had gone through the actual motions of firing him. Bill told him they'd sort things out, either getting him a position at another branch, or at least some back pay so he'd have a cushion while he looked for something new. Eli spent his free time checking in with his friends. Jack in the Box, the fast food franchise, had slipped into Sanders and made a quiet offer for the Emporium building. Corey and Robin had considered it for all of 2 days and accepted it with a little encouraging nudge from Eli.
The tidy sum, more than they'd make in a decade of video rentals, would let Robin go back to art school and Corey launch a Twitch show with a sizable budget. When the gossip mill became too much, Nicole had packed up and moved a few towns over into New Hampshire. A manager position had opened up at one of the big multiplex cinemas in Newington. Eli stopped by to visit and found her planning her film festival. They both smiled and spoke warmly, but the recent events had stomped out whatever spark the two of them might have once had. Nicole kissed him on the cheek as they hugged goodbye, and Eli felt sure he'd never see her again. Even his mom had good news. Despite all of her worry about her son, it turned out the family home sat in a geographically perfect spot for a cell phone tower. The day after he talked with the FBI agent, a company approached her about building on her small patch of land, deep on the back of the property line. The lease was double what she made as a librarian. It seemed as if the American dream had finally caught up with Sanders. And then, right on cue, Eli got fired. Bill asked him if he could swing by the bank. When Eli arrived, his boss, his ex-boss he already suspected, looked close to a panic attack. "She's been waiting to talk to you," said Bill. "She wouldn't leave. Said she wanted to explain things to you personally." Helena stood at the back of the bank next to one of the spare desks. Eli glanced out through the blinds. He didn't see the Cadillac 60 special anywhere in the parking lot, but he couldn't see the whole lot from where he was. Was this another case of timelines not lining up? Could this be an earlier visit from her point of view? He walked closer, away from Bill and the others. Helena stared at him like a bug. A thin scar, at least a year old, ran along the side of her forehead. The kind of thing you'd end up with, he guessed, if someone pistol-whipped you. Truss was still dead. Or dead already. Dead to both of them? Which meant what to Helena? The woman reached into her jacket. Eli tensed, prepared to leap behind the flimsy barrier of the cubicle partition. It wouldn't offer much in the way of protection, but it would keep him out of line of sight, for Helena pulled out an envelope.
"Mr. Elias Teague,"
she said. Her voice had a soft edge, almost a lisp. She had impressive projection, but the air itself blunted her words.
"The situation with your employment has come to the attention of Mr. Truss. I am sure it comes as no surprise that under the terms outlined in your contract, you've been terminated, effective immediately."
Eli said nothing. He'd expected as much.
"However,"
she continued in the same lisping tenor,
"Mr. Truss has offered you a token severance payment in recognition of your years of service."
She held out the envelope. Eli stared at the woman, leaned in a little closer. "Mr. Truss," he murmured, "is dead. Arguably, he's been dead for 130 years. Helena said nothing. "What is this, some kind of final revenge? Hate mail from beyond the grave? Did he buy out my mom's mortgage or get my citizenship revoked or something?" The woman held the envelope out like a blade raised to slash down. Everyone in the bank had their eyes on the exchange, even if they couldn't hear the quieter parts of it. Eli took the envelope, tore it open. When a cloud of poison dust didn't poof out, he opened it all the way. Inside sat a check. A large one. Eli counted 9 digits before the decimal point, then counted again to make sure. "What's this supposed to be?"
"Mr. Truss may have passed on," said Helena, now in a much lower tone, "but he's left an impressive corporate structure behind. One which won't notice his absence for months, maybe even years."
"So you're in charge now?"
"Mr. Truss is in charge,"
she said, blinking too innocently.
"Just as he's always been. And I'll deliver his messages to all the various executives and district managers, just as I always have."
Eli held up the envelope. "So this is a bribe?"
"An incentive,"
lisped Helena.
"I don't want any hard feelings between us. Go out, live the life you always wanted. There are people keeping tabs on you these days. People who would listen to you. As I see it, if you're busy and happy, you won't feel inclined to talk to any of them about me. Which means things here can continue as they are.
So, it's a bribe. Helena smirked.
If it makes you happy to call it that. Either way, you're fired. What happens next is up to you.
Eli folded the envelope and the check and stuffed them in his back pocket.
And what if I decide it's not enough?
She shrugged and reached into her jacket. She pulled something out and pressed it into Eli's palm. She had very warm fingers. A wooden poker chip with golden yellow edges and a pair of marked signs, cents and dollars, each one with two vertical lines running through it.
I owe you one, Helena said. Good enough?
Eli flipped the favor back and forth between his fingers.
Yeah, he said. Yeah, it is.
Then our business is concluded, Mr. Teague,
she said at a regular volume. She gave a short bow, walked past Eli, and gestured for Bill to join her at another desk. Eli walked over to the other spare cubicle. His belongings waited in a box there. He tried to think of anything in the box worth taking home, but decided it would be rude to just leave it behind for Bill or someone else to deal with. The new systems tech, he realized he'd never learned her name, stood up inside her cubicle.
Axed you?
Yeah.
Sucks. It's okay. Better than a couple of years ago,
she agreed. Yeah.
Any tips on keeping everything up and running?
She asked. It had the distinct air of a polite rhetorical question. Nope. Actually, yes. There's a buggy line in the transfer code. I think I flagged it just before I left, but it never got fixed. She glanced down at her computer.
Seriously?
Yeah. Sorry.
You think you flagged it?
He tried to shrug, but the box interfered. Instead, he gestured back at Helena. Mr. Truss showed up in person, messed up the whole day.
She
said, this time in a tone that implied she'd already heard stories about Archibald Truss. Eli nodded. Good luck.
See you around.
Another week passed. He checked in with his mom every day. He went out with his friends on Tuesday night. They smiled at his derby. Robin still wanted to know about the woman who'd given it to him, refusing to believe there wasn't a story with a woman behind the small-brimmed hat. He used his banking skills to set up a few different accounts. His big check went into one, then spread out into the others. He could be rich now or comfortable for the rest of his life. He went with comfortable. More weeks passed by. Eli spent his days walking around town. He visited Jackson's and looked through the last wire comic rack. He stopped by the Emporium during its big closeout sale. He stood outside the theater, which still had last month's playbill taped in the box office window. He bought a nice lunch at the Silver Arrow one day and two oily slices at Pizza Pub on another. Had the buildings in Sanders always been so close together? He tried three different stores in the area, searching for a new coat. He found a thigh-length overcoat he liked in the York thrift store. Simple lines, strong stitches, wooden buttons. One day in early March, he circled the founder's house a dozen times. Nothing moved in the windows or curled from the chimneys. On his 13th circuit, Corey appeared.
Hey, he called out.
Hey, Eli replied.
I thought you guys were still packing.
Corey nodded his head back toward the Emporium, its top floor just peeking out between two other buildings.
We are. Robin saw you walking around over here, recognized the hat.
Eli touched the brim and smiled.
Guess it does make me stand out a bit. Pretty sure it's the only one in town.
Corey lifted his chin and studied the old building.
Remember when we were kids and we'd run up the front steps here?
Yeah.
I gotta be honest, Corey said. Place used to scare the shit out of me when we were little. Even just now, when Robin asked me to come see what you were up to, I got a little case of the heebies.
It's just an old building, said Eli.
Oh, yeah, I know that. Now. But back when we were little, I'm pretty sure monsters lived in it then.
Eli smiled again. Truer words. They started walking again, heading toward the front steps.
So,
Corey said, shoving his hands in his pockets.
What are you doing?
He waved a hand up at the founder's house.
Just looking.
Okay. Eli took off his hat and rubbed the back of his head.
Sorry. Had a lot on my mind. Figured. Corey glanced up at the building again. I've got to be honest. I'm kind of half tempted to chuck a rock in a window. I won't tell anybody. Nah, just my luck Barney'd see me do it too. Goddamn perfect Barney, said Eli. Yeah, tell me about it. I mean, he's making every other guy in town look bad. Can he just gain a couple of pounds or get a zit or something?
They both chuckled, then walked the rest of the way to the big staircase in silence.
So, what are you doing, Eli?
Nothing. Like I said, just looking.
No, I mean...
Corey paused, arranged his thoughts.
You know, when you first vanished before all the Zeke stuff started, you know what we all thought?
What?
Finally. Me and Robin and Josh, even Nicole, we all figured you just finally decided it was time to leave, to go do something with your life.
Eli raised an eyebrow at him.
Look, you know I love you, me and Robin both, but the bank fired you last week, right?
Yeah, almost 10 days ago now.
And you've picked up the check the last 3 times we've gone out, so I know you got a ton of back pay or severance or something.
Severance, said Eli. They were generous.
Corey shrugged.
So what are you waiting for? You're a smart guy. You could do anything, anywhere.
He turned away from the founder's house and looked out across the town.
It's time to move on, buddy.